I'm Barbara Lane, Director of Arts and Ideas at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is veterinarian behaviorist and author Dr. Vint Verga. He's joined in conversation by journalist and writer Amy Standen. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Dr. Vint Verga and Amy Standen. Dr. Vint Verga is a veterinary behaviorist. He's the only person in the country whose full-time job is tending to the psychological welfare of animals in captivity. He works with zoos across the United States and Europe, and like most mental health professionals, he believes his patients have unique personalities and vibrant emotional lives. His recent book is called The Soul of All Living Creatures. What does it mean when an elephant lowers her head and folds her trunk underneath? Or when a monkey snuffles, sounding a little like a hog rooting in the mud? Or a California sea lion stretches one or both rear flippers in the air like synchronized swimmers? Here to enlighten us on all that and more is Dr. Vint Verga, who appears in conversation with KQED and NPR science reporter Amy Standen. Please welcome them both to the JCCSF.
Is there a universal lexicon among animals? I mean, are there certain gestures that you see all animals do, or is it like learning a language that it's sort of species specific?
I think there's similarities, but there's definitely specific languages for different species. They carry across species and into categories of animals. So oftentimes, I see a lot of similarities, frankly, between a lion and a tiger and a leopard and a domestic house cat. Same thing with canids, African wild dogs, wolves, foxes. There's some similarities between them and our domestic cats.
Can you give me some examples?
Apes.
Okay.
Yeah, there's certainly across species, particularly among New World monkeys. There's a lot of similarities in communication. Examples. I think a lot of the body signals using cats as an example, mm-hmm. a lot of the body signals that a leopard or a tiger would give, facial expressions, postures, movements of the tail, are pretty similar between a leopard and a tiger and a domestic house cat. With vocalization, there's a lot more similarities. I think there's, scientists say, depending on which scientist you read their research study, showing our human biases, there's somewhere between 20 and 30 different feline vocalizations. And of those, the vast majority actually do cross over between species. And then, of course, there's differences, too.
How can you tell the difference between, I talk to scientists a lot, and there's a real fear among scientists that, I don't want to anthropomorphize these animals. There's a real reluctance or fear even of attributing a human attribute, or projecting a human attribute onto an animal. And I wonder how you can tell the difference between something that you are expecting an animal to do as a projection of, human expectation and something that they're genuinely doing on their own. And do you struggle with that?
I struggle with it every day. Yeah. Veterinarians are, by nature, by definition, scientists. We're brought up in a traditional medical setting, and we're taught that whole diagnostic paradigm of subjective and objectively assessing an animal and then doing plans and treatments. But working day in and day out with animals, it's also inescapable with anybody that works with animals intimately. It becomes inescapable to not notice. That's a double negative. To not notice that each animal has a unique personality. And we all develop relationships with individual animals. That individuality is a reflection of who they are as a creature, as an individual. And the differences are as real as the differences between you and I. So that in and of itself starts to change the doctor or the worker's relationship with the animals and how they interact with them. How do I balance it in my life? I take the science for the information that it can offer me, and I also take what my eyes and ears and medical intuition tell me. After being in practice for 25, 20, 28 years, my experience with these animals is that when they are responding a certain way, they remind me of another experience with another animal, and I try to balance the two, the cold, hard science and the real-life, day-to-day experience.
It's funny, I mean, this idea that different animals have different personalities is something that any pet owner, of course, knows very well, but it seems like science was sort of reluctant to accept that as an idea, or at least did you find that to be the case early in your...
Sure, yeah, absolutely, and it goes all the way back to Descartes, and the whole idea that animals are basically at that era in our evolution as a species, we were looking to differentiate ourselves from the rest of the world. And somehow this idea that we have dominion over this planet and that we are somehow better and different than the rest of nature came out. And that's something that has persisted in modern science. It is also interesting, though, that as much as that has persisted, the reality is that most veterinarians that I would come into contact with, behaviorists or other, and most scientists I come into contact with, will have a very different private conversation with me than they will out in a scientific forum. Because there's this reluctance about judgment by one's peers, but they know very well what they experience.
What are the kinds of words that you find them not wanting to use in the scientific context? What's something they wouldn't say at a conference?
Oh, well, just an animal having an identity, a personality. Them saying they have a relationship with that animal. Intelligence, that's a really big hot button. To recognize the full intelligence of an animal. You know, the reality is we as humans like to think that we're somehow better and more evolved than other species on this planet. We're evolved. So are they. And we're just really beginning to scratch the surface in terms of understanding that all we are is evolved differently than a lion or an octopus or a rhinoceros. No better, no worse.
That's a very problematic concept, it seems to me. I mean, sort of denying the sentience or the personality or the emotion of other animals has served us well. It lets us do a lot of things that otherwise would be, I think, morally sort of uncomfortable. What are the implications, you know, of starting to think about animals in this very different way?
Well, I think the thing that stands out to me is the most obvious is our animal production system. You know, livestock mm-hmm. production yeah. in this country is... It treats animals in a very much in a mass production type of system, and if we start to recognize that these are not beings, these are beings with a lot greater awareness and intelligence than we have previously recognized, then we've got to start really questioning how, in fact, we're interacting with them, how we're caring for them, what sort of housing, what sort of living conditions we're providing them. If we're going to choose to eat them, even how we end their life.
I mean, that brings to mind to me the work of Temple Grandin and her work around humane slaughtering. I'm not sure what the term is that she uses. I wonder, for you, does that go far enough? I don't know. It's a tough concept to kind of to reckon with.
Yeah. I always say that I don't believe in projecting. I am a vegetarian. It's hard for me. It was a conscious choice as a young vet. It's hard for me to work with animals and then go home and eat them. Mm-hmm. It was a personal choice. But I don't feel like my value system should be the rest of the world's. Having said that, no, I don't feel. I feel that what Temple Grandin has done is a step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. The reality is that I was an animal science major as an undergraduate. And in my upper division courses, I actually took lower division students to slaughterhouses and labs, four labs. And I very well know the livestock production system in this country, from chickens to pigs to cattle. The reality is, quite honestly, that when these animals enter into a feedlot situation, there is no way around it. It's not humane. For them to be out on pasture is natural, and I consider to be relatively humane if they aren't packed together. But to corral them into a pen where you have several hundred cattle and there's no vegetation and they're being fed grain instead of grass, there's nothing about it that fits with their biology or their emotional welfare. And then, even though Temple has worked very hard to design slaughter facilities or abattoirs to minimize the impact or the stress the cattle go through, as a vet, as a veterinary behaviorist, as an animal science student, I saw the fear in those cows and pigs' eyes. They can smell death. They know what's coming. They don't have a choice. They're ushered along or moved along in a system, and the reality is what it is. So I think we have a lot further to go in terms of caring for the animals that we are responsible for.
I'm curious what it's like, having written a book like you wrote. Do you find yourself being torn between, you know, wanting to be an advocate versus wanting to be a scientist? Did you find when you were promoting this book that people sort of didn't want to go there with those? You know, these are really tough, challenging topics. What's your relationship to that kind of, you know, what really is the logical extension of what you write about?
It's been a process for me.
Yeah.
The reality is that I'm 56 years old, and at about 46 years old, I went, I'm not getting any younger. I had these ideas about a book in my mind brewing for quite a while, and a lot of them were topics that I'd had conversations with people about through the years, but mostly it was, I feel, these lessons that the animals, frankly, were hitting me over the head with. And after being hit over the head so many times, I went, okay, I really need to write about this to try to better understand it myself. And I think my judgment, I'm great with self-judgment. And my self-judgment was that...
Mixed blessing.
My self-judgment was, who am I to write about these big issues? Who am I to be talking about provocative issues as far as the veterinary community and the scientific community is concerned? And I finally went, you know, I'm getting older, and if I don't do it now, when am I going to do it? And then there's that other thing that happens somewhere in your 50s where you just kind of go, well, I'm not sure I care. You know, it's like, I'll push a few buttons.
Okay. This is a different sort of question, but I had this experience once with a golden retriever that I need to just run by you. And I'm usually, I'm sorry. I know we all have these questions. I'm usually a cat person, but I was out walking one day and I was alone and I met this golden retriever and she sort of rushed up to me and I started petting her. And we had this, just this incredible, almost rapturous interaction, I felt like. I mean, it was just, you know, the love I felt from this animal was really amazing. And then, you know, I finished and I sort of walked away. And then someone else walked up to the same dog. And this, like, you know, exactly the same interaction all over again. And I felt sort of cheapened to me by this, you know, and so fickle. That's sort of a, you know, what I'm getting at is I think we all have, or many of us have had this feeling of real love and tenderness and affection with an animal. Is that a mutual, you know, are we imagining it? Are we projecting our needs or desires or, you know, is that love?
That was actually the topic of the very first interview I ever did as a resident at Cornell, and an article had come out in the Atlantic about just this topic. So, in terms of the specific situation, you were with a golden.
So, the
golden retrievers,
no,
we have bred this breed to be basically, you know, love on 4 feet. The prototypical golden is always there by our side, looking at us with adoring eyes, just waiting for that moment of attention. Virtually anything, just about any activity that they can even squeeze out a drop of enjoyment is like a huge, exciting joy to them. But was that golden in that experience or in that situation expressing joy? No doubt. Was he loving the connection with you? Yes. Was it this long, meaningful, loving moment where 20 years from now he's going to, or no, he's a golden, 5 years from now he's going to remember that? Probably not. You might, but he's going to have moved on to the ball and the rabbit. And but does that same golden have a very intimate, loving relationship with his owner? I was in veterinary, I've been in veterinary practice for 28 years. And from private practice to emergency work to behavioral work, I have no doubt in my mind that the animals in our lives experience love on a very similar level to that which we experience. We are only beginning to fathom that the similarities in our brains translate to similarities in experiences. And it's happening species by species where the scientific community is saying, chimpanzees are similar to us. So we can say that they're intelligent. Okay, well, now there's dolphins too. And elephants. Okay, now it's octopuses. And the same thing happens not only with intelligence, but with emotions and self-awareness. It used to be thought that no animal in this world was self-aware except humans, or we're animals. But that's one place that we're distinct from the rest of the animal kingdom. And now more and more they're finding out it was a flaw in our design of experiments, not my design, the scientist's design of experiments, where we can test it, we're finding more and more species are actually self-aware.
I'm so curious. How do you test self-awareness?
Well, the classic scientific experiment, what they would do is they would stick a mirror in front of an animal. And if they recognized that, if the animal recognized that that was themselves, then they're self-aware. And if they don't, they're not self-aware. Well, how is that necessarily self-awareness? The animal doesn't have anywhere to place the mirror in terms of experience. So the test parameters just don't even make sense.
But it seems that the more we ask and the more we get better at looking, the more we discover our yes. similarities.
Yeah, we are not alone.
You're listening to Dr. Vint Verga, veterinarian and author of The Soul of All Living Creatures. He's joined in conversation by journalist Amy Standen on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Right down to the kinds of mental illnesses that humans experience, OCD, depression. Can you tell me a story about OCD in an animal, what it looked like and what you
sure.
did about it?
Sure. I talk about an OCD case.
Obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, obsessive compulsive disorder. I talk about an OCD case in my book. Dougal was an Irish wolfhound. I came to know him fairly early into the behavior part of my career. And he lived in a rural setting, if I remember, a semi-rural setting, a suburban setting. And his particular idiosyncrasy, if we could call it that, was he would spend most of his day and a good part of his night in the front of his house, primarily in the living room, but he would go to other rooms, and he seemed to be preoccupied with chasing bugs. When I came to see him, he wasn't actually chasing any types of bugs. He was chasing actually shadows and reflections, and this was all triggered initially by seeing the reflection of headlights from passing cars early in the morning. As they would pass by on the street, and they would shine onto the living room walls. And Dougal initially would find himself chasing after those reflections. That's the compulsive part of the behavior. But OCD in humans and in animals is driven by obsessions. The compulsion is just the acting out or the coping strategy. And the obsession was actually looking for the reflections. So Dougal would actually go and get up at 3, 4 in the morning, well before the commuter would even start driving on the road, and patiently wait in his living room till the first headlight would hit an hour or two later. So he was showing clear obsessive tendencies of focusing. An obsession is basically performing a mental act or having a recurrent image or thought entering into our mind. So there's an example of OCD in a dog.
What did your sessions with, I'm sorry, I'm forgetting his name,
Dougal.
Look like? I mean, is it the 45 minutes?
Yeah, I'd put
couch?
Him on. He'd sit on the
Monday,
sofa,
Tuesday,
and I'd say,
Wednesday,
"Come up here, Dougal,"
yeah.
and we'd talk about it. And
yeah.
I'd send him home. Time's up. Yeah. See you next week.
I mean, so do you go and do sort of, you know, no. sit? I just surf, you know, you walk in the door, and then what do you do?
I got the best job in the world. I get paid to watch animals and try to figure out what they're thinking and feeling. I'm lucky, and so what I did is I went to Dougal's home and met the family, talked to the kids, and the parents, and I watched Dougal, but I didn't get to see enough of his behavior, so I asked his family to start recording video for me, and they shipped video to my office back then on. Nowadays, it's done on the
VHS tapes.
Yeah, just yeah. And studying them, it became very, very clear to me. Combined with doing a very detailed behavioral history, so you know, I say tongue in cheek, I talk to Dougal, but in reality, what I'm not doing much talking at all. What I do can look actually really boring, but it's incredibly rich to me because what I'm doing is watching and listening and trying to step out of my human shoes and into the footsteps of an animal to try to better understand what they're experiencing.
Do you tell the other humans to get out of the room? You're having alone time with Dougal.
No. I just the opposite. I want everything to be just as if I wasn't there. So what I actually do, even is the same at zoos. I like to sit on the sidelines and watch as much as I can about the animal and about the relationship we have with them.
How long will you stay there with them?
Well, if I have my druthers, sometimes a long time. That's like where it can be pretty boring.
Hours and hours and
hours? I can spend a few hours watching an animal if I have the opportunity. My favorite time to get to the zoo is before anybody's even gotten there. Mm-hmm. And to watch the keepers arrive and to watch the interactions with the animals as they are either coming back from their habitat or going out onto their habitat from their sleeping quarters, and to just watch it all evolve. The more I can be an inert observer in the environment, the more I can fully appreciate everything that's going on. And then, of course, I want my time with the animal, too. You know, I want my time with the golden or with the clouded leopard,
right,
or with the porcupine.
I do want to talk about zoos, but first I need to know how you helped Dougal with his OCD.
Well, OCD is, by definition, an anxiety disorder. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, we can't do CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, with animals. And the type of behavioral therapy that I would do in terms of environmental modification wasn't sufficient for Dougal, as it is not sufficient for most animals with OCD. So OCD is one of the few conditions for which I actually prescribe anxiolytics or anti-anxiety drugs. And I think I put Dougal on fluoxetine or Prozac, and ultimately he ended up on a Zoloft or Sertraline, and a booster medication, a trazodone or Desiree, and he lived in terms of quality of life, he went back to having a normal interaction and relationship and rich life with the kids. Mm-hmm. Instead of staring at reflections, he would go into the backyard and play with the kids and eat meals instead of staring at walls and having normal relationship with a family.
It sounds a little bit, you sounded initially like you were sort of reluctant to prescribe this. I mean, do you feel like these medications are overprescribed in animals these days?
Well,
it's sort of a funny question.
There's no other veterinary behaviors in the audience. I think they are to some degree in companion animal practice. In zoo practice, I don't get the luxury of prescribing medication. Very often. And it's by choice, but also by design, because it think about the reality of giving a medication once or twice a day to a tegu, a lizard, or a porcupine, or a gorilla.
Not a lot of dosage studies out
what we have to do is that then becomes part of my job, is making sure that we get them to basically cooperate so that they are voluntarily taking their medication. But the reality is, in zoo practice, I prescribe medication less than 5% of the time.
I'm not sure I understand why it would be wrong to, I mean, is it a practical consideration, like you don't know how a lizard would absorb Prozac, or is it that there's something wrong with trying to get zoo and medicating them into accepting their status in life as a zoo animal?
It's a bias I have.
Okay.
When I was in companion animal behavioral practice, mm-hmm, I prescribed much more medication. I think that it was necessary. Everything we do in order to change our behavior, we basically can do it one of two ways. We either have to or we want to change a behavior. Okay? So the problem is that in many family settings, the family, when by the time they make it to a veterinary behaviorist, they need this behavior changed. You know, look at Dougal's behavior, for example. Mm-hmm. If for the welfare of the family, for the welfare of the relationship, for the welfare of the animal. We, I think, as a species, tend to be very impatient and want things to happen quickly. And medications can have a very valuable role in terms of helping out in terms of changing behavior. The reality is, if we look at the neurochemistry of our brains, what we now know is that learning changes our neurochemistry and our microanatomy of our brains, as does pharmacologic support. So they go hand in hand. You can't say one is right and one's wrong. But in the zoo community, because we don't generally have the same type of time agenda, and also because we have people who are there 8 to 12 hours a day working for one reason, for the welfare of the animal, They aren't family members. Their job is to do everything possible to care for this animal. We can make incredible strides through behavior modification that would be problematic in a family where the kids are going to school, you and I are going to work, and we've got this dog or cat at home by themselves or with their companions. Mm-hmm. So they aren't comparable circumstances. Yeah. I don't mean to come across saying medication's bad, and OCD in a zoo animal, I will prescribe an anxiolytic too, because by definition, OCD tends to be very resistant to behavior modification.
You write very supportively of people who work in zoos. I mean, you describe them as people who really genuinely love animals, who work long hours at low pay, really often sometimes just tiring, grueling work. And yet, I know, you know, a lot of us, myself included, find zoos almost unbearably sad places to be sometimes. Is there something wrong with the institution of a zoo? Or, you know, I don't know, or not. Or is there such a thing as a zoo that is a great, happy place for animals to be?
You know, I traveled to a lot of zoos. I traveled to some very progressive ones, and I traveled to some that are a little more antiquated. Even at the most progressive zoos, I can turn the corner from a habitat where I see the animals living what I consider to be a really rich, enriched life, fulfilling life, and see another habitat that it haunts me. I used to stay away from zoos with a passion. And as I started getting invited to do zoo cases, what became clear to me is I had a choice. I could either resist the structure of zoos, or I could work within the system to try to bring about change. And I took the latter on as my cause. So the reality is, everywhere I go, there are animals that I'm struggling and fighting for that cause a tremendous amount of heartache, and I lose sleep over. And then there are animals that in my heart, I know that they're living a very rich, full life. Now there are plenty of people out there that feel like zoos are evil, period, and they should be banned. The animals should just be let out in the wild. The reality is, zoos are not going to go away. Most animals, the vast majority of animals in zoos today, are captive bred. They're many generations away from their wild cousins, and they would have to go through incredible programs, sometimes unrealistic programs, to actually survive out in the wild. both socially with others of their species, in terms of hunting skills or surviving as prey, and just living with nature. And these are tough questions. The bigger question that I'm struggling with, that I'm writing about in my next book, is even the reality of the world we live in. More and more species out there are living in conditions that are defined by us as humans, in terms of climate, in terms of habitat loss, in terms of being hunted upon by man, in terms of pollution. This idea that these animals are living in this unadulterated wilderness or in zoos isn't the reality of our modern world. And what really troubles me and keeps me awake at night nowadays is these animals that are out in the wild that we are treating as if we aren't changing their lives, and yet we're impacting them day to day in terms of what we're doing to the environment around us.
Sounds like there's a specific animal you're thinking of, at least in that last, or not?
Not really, no. Yeah. I mean, I could give an example of polar bears. You know,
I
don't know.
Yeah.
I was starting to write an article at one point, and then I went, that's got to be part of the book, where I don't know, which is... I see very few zoos that I like the polar bear habitat. It isn't rich enough. It isn't large enough.
Mm-hmm.
There are a few out there. But look what's happening with their native habitat in the Arctic. And the reality is that they may very well go extinct within 50 years. I don't know how to reconcile that when I think of my daughter at 11 years old, and when she's an adult, her children, how I feel like as our generation needs to hand off something to our children in that at least is way better than what we're currently leaving our children.
Honey, I asked you about zoos. And it started to feel like the concern about zoos is it's sort of missing the point in a way. I mean, it's the loss of wilderness, really.
Yeah. And zoos do serve a very valuable purpose. You know, they were designed hundreds of years ago, and in the past century even, primarily as entertainment. Nowadays, their primary mission is conservation, education, preservation of some gene pools. It's very frustrating to me sometimes when I go to zoos, and I can think of a gibbon at one particular zoo that I'm saying, okay, he has lived alone now for the past couple of years, which is not great for a gibbon. Let's get him. We would love to, but the SSP, the Species Survival Program, which oversees the gene pool of gibbons out there in the greater world and in zoos, says, well, we don't have anybody that we can put him with right now. If we could, right now, we have a shortage of females, and we need a female, so he's on the waiting list. But zoos also, one thing that isn't talked about is that I think is a vital purpose of zoos is that they provide a way for us to experience animals that we wouldn't otherwise. You can look at TV and slides all you want, but it isn't until you get to meet that golden retriever or you get to see that polar bear in person that you can have any type of experience of them. And my hope is seeing that clouded leopard, seeing that polar bear, will inspire more people to go, I need to think about those animals out there in nature. I care more about them now. What's happening with them? And that's a vital role, I think, of zoos.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features Dr. Vint Verga, veterinarian and author of The Soul of All Living Creatures. He's joined in conversation by journalist Amy Standen. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Your wife is also a veterinarian, and you have an 11-year-old daughter. I'm curious, does she seem to care about animals? You know, some people are animal people, and some people just aren't.
Oh, no, of course you.
What if she isn't?
I think we're the whole family is of course animal people, but she doesn't care for the zoo animals like I do.
She doesn't?
No, she's a veterinary dermatologist, she prefers working with companion animals. And
right.
And my daughter doesn't think, you know, she's got that preteen syndrome where what daddy does isn't cool, you know, it's just kind of ordinary.
One more question about zoos, a practical one. What is the one thing, the change that you would like to see happen at all zoos? I mean, as someone who visits a lot of them, what is the mistake that too many of them make?
Ah, I have an answer for that one. I would love to see zoos become more focused on species that make sense for their region or their part of the world. So obviously you wouldn't put a polar bear in a zoo in Arizona. But for them to specialize, and I know that there's a tendency for zoos to want to provide their visitors, it's driven by public demand, provide their visitors an experience of going to different parts of the world. But I think by not having as diverse a population of animals, they could provide them with more habitat, and they could become experts on those species. And that would become one of the things that we would look forward to when we went to different parts of the country or different parts of the world, that we would then look at those animals that are native to that type of habitat and that type of terrain.
That's tough, though. I mean, you know, we all want to see the giraffe and the elephant and the, you know, the tiger and the orangutan. And I mean, and you were just saying a moment ago, this is how children are introduced to at least the idea of wilderness. I don't know. That's you sort of find yourself butting heads with people that, you know, who run zoos on that question.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they probably worry that attendance would go way down if they weren't providing the sort of charismatic, you know, megafauna.
And yet zoos are being forced to slowly reconcile their struggles with certain species.
Yeah.
So it's very, very difficult to provide a sufficient enriched habitat for an elephant. It's very, very difficult to provide the same for a whale, a dolphin. And a polar bear. And I think I go to zoos where they say, we have these animals, but we don't intend to have them 50 years from now.
I see.
So we certainly aren't going to do that in the future.
One last question before we turn to the audience for some questions. I'm interested in the fact that mental illnesses do not seem to appear in wild animals. They seem to be conditions that occur when animals are in captivity, though I imagine that's a hard thing to study. But what does that suggest to you, if this isn't too large of a leap, about our own human mental health and what we need to be happy? And, or do you get nervous, you know, those kinds of leaps? No, you're fine.
No.
You're cool with that. Okay,
no.
Run with it. This is not a scientific conference, so.
So what I feel is that the catch in that is that based on research out there, there's very few mental or behavioral conditions we see in animals. But that's also starting to change. I think it's a result, frankly, of our manipulating the environment. And when we manipulate the natural environment in to a degree that it starts compromising the integrity of the animal, and I refer to integrity, or I think of integrity as the whole of a being, their ability to express a good part or fulfill a good part of their behavioral repertoire. Maybe not express it all. You know, we don't want our cats to be hunting lizards and mice in the house. But, for example, we can encourage our cats to hunt for treats and food and catnip and toys throughout the house. Giving an animal an ability to express themselves and to find fulfillment in their lives, well, when we start taking that away, then we start seeing behavioral sequelae or consequences. I think the same thing's true with us, with ourselves. So we start defining, we as humans tend to approach the world oftentimes feeling like we want to control our world. And animals by the other species on our planet, by nature, don't do that. They adapt to their world a whole lot better than we do. So when we don't adapt, I think we start seeing the types of behavioral issues that we see in behavioral practice in humans. And what that says is that I don't think we're going to be able to change dramatically, certainly not quickly, our natural habitat and our artificial habitat in which we live in. For some people, that it might be a matter of moving from the city to the country or moving from the country to the wilds. But we can take a big lesson from animals in terms of learning to adapt to our world instead of trying to control it on a physical level and on an emotional level. I feel like I do my share of trying to control my emotions every day. And I don't know that is emotionally or spiritually the best path. I think a path of flexibility and adapting and learning. The biggest lesson I take every day home from my work is learning from the animals' lives how they adapt to their world and saying, oh, how could I do a better job doing the same?
Thank you.
So you mentioned that in zoos, a lot of your work is behavior modification instead of drugs. Can you give us a specific example of a behavior modification that you suggested in a zoo that worked?
Oh, wow. Sure. I'm working with a barn owl right now. His name's Oscar. And Oscar was incredibly afraid of everybody, which basically looked like when he would basically hide from everybody that could possibly go by his habitat, and he would hide from the keepers when the keepers, his primary keeper, even tried to enter into his habitat. He would start flying into the top of the aviary, the sides of the aviary, in a panic state. And the first thing that we did at this particular zoo is we moved Oscar off exhibit so that he had a new habitat where he wasn't stressed by zoo visitors. So that's changing his environment. We gave him a few weeks to adapt to that, and prior to adapting, prior to moving him into that environment, we provided a way in terms of the design of the environment and the space that the keepers could come and do what they had to do, and he could have a safe place to go to. So basically, the first thing is helping him. The cardinal rule I follow with every animal, including Oscar, is that they need to feel like they have control over their environment. How would you like it if instead of people coming to your door and knocking at the door, they just came and walked in and you had people walking into your home, looking in the windows while you're having dinner, or while you're trying to read or relax in the evening, it would be very stressful to us. And we need to provide animals an opportunity to have a way to escape from the visitors' eyes. They have an opportunity to interact with the keepers if they want to. Giving them the choice, then what we did with Oscar is giving him the choice. Then what we did is we started to make the most favorable things that would happen in terms of treats and food and the person he was least afraid of being more pleasurable by providing. That's when he would get his favorite things, which were pinkies, little you know, newborn mice that are not fully. I don't need to say more. And so there were starting to be some really nice things that if Oscar wanted to, he could come out and meet his keeper, and if he didn't want to, he didn't. And we started to make it where she would just then go to a neutral place in the habitat, and he could choose to interact or not. And as he saw that she wasn't doing any more than just standing there, leaving pinkies on his tree, then eventually he would start to approach. Then eventually she could actually walk up to him. Eventually he would come and perch on her glove. And it became where her presence was a very pleasurable thing. And where we're at now with Oscar is generalizing that so that relief keepers and educational staff can also go into his habitat. But the starting point with every animal is recognizing that's their home, that's their habitat.
Hi. I read your book, and I loved it. I have two cats, but I have a couple of concerns. One is... we keep hearing on the news about how mountain lions are coming down from, you know, their habitat. We are encroaching on their habitat. And, a lot of times they get killed. And this is very distressing. I mean, what can we do so we can live, with these animals on whose habitat we're encroaching?
In terms of the habitat struggle, whether it's cougars or wolves or any species in which we or bears up in Alaska, there is no great answer because humans by nature have different tastes and different desires, and you can't say to people, well, what we need to do is live within these boundaries and let animals have those boundaries. But what we can try to do is set aside terrains where it's okay, and to also encourage those animals to live within those terrains by not encroaching upon those environments and also making sure that they're habitable. And then a huge part of it, frankly, is education. All the scientific data out there, switching from cougars over to wolves, all the data out there shows that wolves are not a threat to the livestock production system in the Rockies, and in fact, they actually help benefit it. But there's the acculturation of the people in that part of the country that raise livestock, and that's a matter of slowly and patiently just presenting the same information and hopefully opening hearts and minds.
Could you speak about any cutting-edge research on animal communication?
Animal communication. Again, I'm not a researcher. I'm a clinician by heart. And what I can tell you is a trend in the latest research is that what we are finding is that basically backing up what I experience and what other veterinary behaviorists experience in day-to-day practice, and that is that animals are communicating to us just fine. What we're not doing is we're not understanding their signals. And I think the greatest strides in terms of research right now are in trying to revisit what it is that animals are communicating and better understand so that then we can understand them a whole lot better. About a year ago, I got a telephone call, and it was one of the most curious telephone calls I've ever gotten. It was preceded by an email from my publicist at Random House, and she goes, and I read this inquiry, and I didn't really believe it. And so I said, sure, I'll talk to this guy. And the guy was, the reason it was one of the most curious calls is because it started out with, I met another vent. I didn't know there was another vent. I thought I was by myself in the world. But this guy was actually, his real name is Vint. His name's Vint Cerf. And he's actually the president of Google, the Google. And he had partnered with two different researchers, one in animal communication and one more in the technical arena, and Peter Gabriel, the musician. And he wanted to invite me to provide feedback to this team that they decided to form. And I said, well, I'll provide feedback on one condition, if I can become part of the team. And the team, believe it or not, is working on creating an interspecies internet. I know, it's mind-blowing. Where we would actually, and this is being led and spearheaded by the guy that's basically one of the fathers of the current internet, who envisioned what it was going to be 30 years before its time. And he has this new vision that we can communicate with animals, and they can communicate with us using the internet. How that's going to happen, I don't know. But that's about as leading edge as I think that as I can even imagine.
Thanks so much to all of you for coming tonight. Most of all, Amy, thank you. And thank you, Dr. Vint Cerf. Good night. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and 91.7 KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was Dr. Vint Verga, veterinarian and author of The Soul of All Living Creatures. He was joined in conversation by journalist and writer Amy Standen. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Brandon Battaglia, Ben Tuttle, Ben Bernardi, Maya Finley, and Alex Espelay. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I invite you to tune in again next Thursday at noon when Bina will feature broadcast journalist Leslie Stahl. I'm Barbara Lane. Thanks for listening.